I'd like to welcome you to the second day of the conference, third day overall. Again, good morning and welcome back. I'm glad that many of you were able to negotiate the snow and the roads and get in here. We have now fulfilled one of the annual traditions of the conference, that someday during the conference there'll be bad weather and the conference goes on. Nothing like last year. Last year was the ultimate test when on day one of the conference there was a snow day statewide, and still we had people coming. I appreciate that. Today, Curriculum Associates is helping to support the conference, and I'd like to thank them for the support because that helps to keep your fees down and makes it easier for you to get approval to come. Before we get started, there are a couple of people that I would like to thank that have helped to make this possible. One of those is Sue Shafkin from U of M Conference Services. She's always running around and handing me little cards with reminders of things to say and do. Also Daniel Bach and Phil Mara from MASA that helped with the registration. And Phil yesterday was on camera for about 12 hours. And the people in the Upper Peninsula said they really appreciated that. There was actually a large crowd at Copper Country ISD, I think about 20 people, which would be the equivalent down here of about 300 people showing up at your office. I think probably half of the educators in Copper Country County were probably watching. So, and of course, we're beholden to Dean Elizabeth Moshi and Ed Silver for their support for the conference. It has been a U of M conference, a School of Education conference for 60 years, and at lunch we're going to ask for your indulgence to celebrate. None of us were here for the first conference. I can say that because I know between the Marge Mastey and myself, neither one of us were here then. But the conference has still meant a lot to us, and we want to pay tribute to the conference and to the founder, Frank Womer. So, and then, of course, we wouldn't have the sessions that we feature here without a planning committee. And I know several of you are in the audience, so I'd like for the members of the planning committee to stand. Their names are listed inside the program, but if you're on the planning committee, don't be bashful. Thank you. And you'll notice the little tent card, the triangular tent card. If I knew my geometric figures, I would tell you what that is. One little correction: the resources URL that's on it does not take you; it takes you to a dead end. Therefore, don't use the QR code; use the URL that's listed. Also, the MASA registration page that you use to register for the conference has access to the conference materials, and I think just about every presenter has uploaded materials. And so you'll want to, that doesn't stay up there infinitely. So if you're interested in those, please do download them quickly. As we did yesterday, please silence your cell phones. We had no cell phone shaming yesterday, and I'd like to repeat that today. We did have a couple of lost items. A power cord was left in Grande 3 on Tuesday, and a Yeti cup at the desk in the lobby yesterday. So if there are items that you're missing, let me know. And at the end of the day, make sure to recycle your name badges. And the sketch of forms are to be turned at the end of the day as well. After this session, we're gonna move this air wall here. We ask you to vacate the room if you're in this part, even if you're coming back for a session. That's a safety issue. We don't wanna hit anybody with a wall. And I don't think you'll want to be hit by a wall either. So if you're sitting in that section over there, Michigan 3 through 5, please exit the room, even if you're kind of come back for a session, until they put the drywall up there. It's a vestige of our tradition as well. When we were at the Kensington, we all had to exit all of the rooms. And so we maintain a little vestige of the traditions so that you feel like you're part of the heritage of the conference. At this point, I'd like to stop, though, and welcome Ed Silver from the School of Education. Ed's a longtime colleague and friend, and he is, I know, going to have the privilege of introducing our speaker, who I think you're going to enjoy and learn from. Ed?
Yeah. Good morning. So I bring you greetings from Elizabeth Burr-Moji, the Dean of the School of Education at the University of Michigan. She was unable to be here, so I'm filling in for her, and I have the privilege of introducing the Womer lecturer today. This is a, you know, as Ed has mentioned before, this lectureship is made possible by a gift from Frank Womer and his family that has allowed us to invite someone who has a reputation of that's unusual in the world of being someone who is highly respected in the research and academic community and also in the practice community, someone whose work actually makes a difference in the lives of folks like yourselves who are here at the conference striving to make education better day to day. So this year, the person who was selected is James Pellegrino. And Jim is currently a distinguished professor of cognitive psychology and distinguished professor of education at the University of Illinois Chicago, where he also serves as the co-director of UIC's Learning Sciences Research Institute. And in my opinion, the approbation of distinguished is distinguished professor fits Jim Pellegrino quite appropriately. He's an elected member of the National Academy of Education, a fellow of the American Educational Research Association, a lifetime national associate of the National Academy of Sciences, and a past member of the Board on Testing and Assessment of the National Research Council. He's authored or co-authored over 275 books, chapters, journal articles, and reports in the area of cognition, instruction, and assessment, and has made numerous invited presentations at local, state, national, and international meetings and at universities around the world. And I thought, you know, I'd just read you all the titles of the 275 articles and books, but then I realized then he'd have no time, so I won't bother. But let me just say that Jim's research and development interests have long been in the area of children's and adults' thinking and learning and the implications of cognitive research and theory for assessment and instructional practice. Much of his current work is focused on analyses of complex learning, instructional environments, including those incorporating powerful information technology tools, with the goal of better understanding the nature of student learning and the conditions that enhance deep understanding. Special concern of his research is the incorporation of effective formative assessment practices assisted by technology to maximize student learning and understanding. Jim has served as the head of several National Academy of Science and National Research Council study committees. I'll just name ones that you have probably read the reports of or heard about: the Study Committee on the Evaluation of National and State Assessments of Educational Progress, the Committee on Learning, Research, and Educational Progress, and Educational Practice, rather, that produced Knowing What Students Know, which is a very influential book on the science and design of educational assessment, the Study Committee on Deeper Learning and 21st Century Skills, the Study Committee on Developing Assessments of Science Proficiency, K-12. He's worked on a number of state-level assessment initiatives, including several here in the state of Michigan, so he's well-known here in the state, and it's statewide systems of assessment that serve as the focus of his talk here today. It's my great pleasure to stop talking and turn things over to Jim Pellegrino, who is the Womer lecturer today, and the distinguished Jim Pellegrino.
Do you need to mic me up?
Okay.
Okay.
Well, good morning. Thank you, Ed. I appreciate the introduction. I was reflecting back on the various committees we've been on serving together. In fact, you mentioned the NRC committee that produced Knowing What Students Know. You were a major contributing member of that, along with many other scholars. So I am really honored to have been asked to represent the Womber Lecture, given the incredible contributions that Frank Womber made to the field of educational assessment and measurement. And so it is really a distinct honor to be able to talk to you about issues of assessment. And so today, what I want to talk about is the issue of assessment systems and try to cover a wide swath of ground in terms of what are these things, why do we need them, and how might we begin to construct them here in Michigan. And I'm going to take a particular focus on this because it's going to be addressed to particular issues that have arisen in the state of Michigan. So my talk today, and I will try to get through it in the time that's been allotted. So there's four things that I want to try to cover. First of all is sort of a brief discussion of what's at stake here in Michigan. That is the issue of developing early literacy assessment systems in Michigan. Many of you know that is required of districts, and so many of you have probably been thinking about that and thinking about what is that and how can we do that. I have had the privilege of working with folks, I'll say a little bit more about that, on developing thinking about how that might happen. The second thing I want to do, however, is lay a foundation of some foundational understandings about assessment systems, and about early literacy assessment that constitute the groundwork for the third piece of this, which is a set of guiding principles for an early literacy assessment system, in particular with respect to three phases: designing such a system, implementing such a system, and then supporting and monitoring that. And then, I'll use this one. All right. So the last part is to introduce a guide that's been developed to help districts on the journey to developing such a system, and mention some of the next steps. So those are the four things I want to cover. So let me start with just a brief mention, which some things you probably already know already, about the Michigan early literacy context. There are a set of critical literacy and assessment issues in the state of Michigan. For one thing, we know that literacy rates should be better than they are in Michigan, and we also know that in order to impact that, we need to focus on the early development of literacy and ways in which we can support that through a variety of actions in the area of instruction and assessment. We also know that there's an excellent foundation that has been established and a considerable momentum to improve literacy instruction in the state. An example of that is the theory of action that is depicted here, that was developed by a variety of constituencies in the state of Michigan with respect to essentially improving literacy and literacy instruction in the state. We also know that is this thing faded out again? Okay. We also know that districts are required by law to implement assessment systems that should help to improve these literacy rates. Another thing we know is that across the spectrum of education, there is understanding, but limited understanding, of the role that assessment can play in supporting learning. So what we have right now is a need for assessment literacy support that's going to enable educators and a variety of stakeholders at all levels to implement assessment systems that can serve to improve literacy achievement for Michigan's children. We know that is a target. We know it is a large lift. We know there's lots of things to do to get there. So to address the challenge, the Michigan Department of Education enlisted the assistance of the Michigan Assessment Consortium, those of you know it as MAC, to do two things: to try to promote an understanding about what an early literacy assessment system is or might be, and second of all, to illustrate or try to provide guidance and information about how to develop such a system so it can actually promote effective development of literacy for Michigan's children. Again, this is a big goal, and it is not a simple matter to think about how we provide that guidance and get there. But the goal is really to figure out how we can produce information that is of value so that it can support districts in developing and implementing and utilizing an early literacy assessment system that is really designed to promote student learning, that essentially connects up with other aspects of the system, including curriculum and instruction, all of which are directed and coherent in terms of how they focus on improving literacy. Now, I've had the privilege over the last 15 months of working with an extraordinary group. Not only are they extraordinary, they're actually amazing individuals on so many levels in terms of what it's like to work with them. Ed knows from having served on NRC committees, trying to bring groups of 15 or more people together to tackle a report, to produce a synthesis, is no small task, especially in 15 months. But this has been an extraordinary group to work with, representing diverse expertise. And so what I'm here talking about today is really the product of this group of people. It is not the product of me alone, it is the product of us as a group, this principal contributor group, who have thought through, argued, figured out how to try to put something together that will help the districts in Michigan with respect to developing these early literacy assessment systems. And I've had the privilege of working with them, and of course we've been facilitated by the extraordinary efforts of Ed and Kathy and Brandy and everyone who is on that, who's shown on that slide. So let me sort of tell you the story, so to speak, as we've tried to evolve it. And I'll start with what I call some foundational understandings, because if we're going to talk about an assessment system, and what is it and what goes into it and why do we need it and how would we use it, we have to start with some fundamentals to remind ourselves about assessment itself. And to start this, I actually want to go back to the report that Ed and I worked on, the Knowing What Students Know report from the National Research Council, which was published way back in 2001. And in that report, one of my favorite sort of reminiscences about that report was we brought the National Research Council, with support from the National Science Foundation, brought, I think, 18 experts together. We sat around tables and argued and did things for 18 months, wrote a report, and the best we could come up with was a triangle. But it's a very important triangle in terms of what it conveys about assessment as some fundamental ideas. And the assessment triangle is depicted here really has three elements: cognition, observation, and interpretation. And we start with something we call cognition. Basically, all assessment should emanate from what is our contemporary theories, what is our contemporary models, our contemporary research on how students represent knowledge and develop competence in some particular domain of instruction and learning, whether it's reading, literacy, mathematics, science. The way in which we conceive of what it means to know and what we want students to know and be able to do is foundational, since those assumptions drive the next part of the assessment process, which is the observations. It drives the tasks or the situations, the things we put in front of kids and ask them to say or do or act out, because those observations are a reflection of what's important to be able to see from students with respect to the underlying competencies we're interested in. And of course, That doesn't solve the problem. We still have to have a way to make sense of that data, that evidence from those observations, relative to be able to reflect back on the underlying conception that we're interested in. What aspect of literacy are we interested in? What aspect of reading we're interested in? So these three things, cognition, observation, and interpretation, need to be coordinated with each other, and they drive the process. And so I think one big message of this is that most of us, when we think about assessment, we think of the observation piece. That is, what's the test? What are the tasks? What are the things? But we don't often think about directly what's the conception about reading or mathematics that's underlying that assessment, that's driving that assessment, because that's also driving the interpretation and limiting, in some cases, the interpretation we can make about students' competence. So this is another way of saying that this entire process has to be driven by models of the development of domain knowledge and skill. Those models, those conceptions that come from theory, research, practice, are really critical because they tell us, they give us clues about the most important aspects of knowledge and skill that we should be assessing at particular points in time. They also give us then clues as to how such competencies can and should be assessed, which means that they give us direction as to the kinds of things we want kids to be able to answer, the kinds of questions we want them to be able to answer, the kinds of performances we want to see. And that then can lead to assessments that yield more instructionally useful information. We are very much interested in moving away from just having large-scale assessment, which provides limited information of a diagnostic nature, to assessments that are far more diagnostic and prescriptive with respect to improving the learning, the teaching and learning process. So these models of development and domain knowledge in areas of literacy then can guide the development of systems of assessment. Because these systems of assessment, they need to be able to work across time. They need to be able to work across a variety of contexts. Time in terms of from pre-K up through elementary school, and the contexts can range from the home to early childhood education to what's happening in school in grades 1 through 3. So there's a takeaway here, which is about literacy assessments, which is for assessments of literacy to be valid and useful, they have to be tied to what we know from research and theory about what are the critical components of literacy and how they develop over time with quality instruction. So that is fundamental to this entire thing. You cannot build an assessment system without having valid, useful assessments that are tied to a strong conception of literacy or the components of literacy and its development. Of course, we also have to remember and answer the question, well, why do we do assessment? Why do we do this at all? In many cases, the perspective of many educators is we do this because we want to punish people, not because we want to help them. And this is failing to recognize that one of the reasons why we do assessment, why we gather evidence of a variety of sorts, is because we're trying to figure out the condition of the situation and do something to improve it. We don't just want to audit things, we want to improve things. And so therefore, the whole idea is to collect evidence that's meaningful, that has value, that has interpretive purpose, that is going to allow educators at different levels of the system to act on behalf of improving things for kids. That's really why we do assessment. And it should be foremost in our minds, and rather than just oftentimes thinking about assessment as a process of compliance. We don't just do assessment for compliance. Yes, we are required by various policies to do that, but that's not the sole reason. In fact, I would argue it's not the best reason to do assessment at all. We also have to recognize that assessment, there are multiple users, multiple stakeholders, multiple consumers of assessment and assessment information. And this slide just depicts the range of stakeholders that ranges from children and families through obviously teachers to administrators and school leadership teams to policymakers. All of these individuals essentially in some ways need information that comes from assessments. They are stakeholders, consumers of that information, and they all need that. Okay. Moderating the, now I have to stand back here. Okay. They all need this information because they have different questions. This next slide sort of tries to capture the various kinds of questions and the various purposes for assessment, because assessment doesn't just satisfy one purpose, it actually... Stop dead in my tracks there. Okay, are we moderating this to some reasonable level? Okay, so here's essentially some of the purposes. So we might sort of say at the policy, the administrator level, we have the purpose of accountability. At the school level, we have program evaluation, resource allocation. Okay, how are things going? Where do I need to invest resources? Maybe for screening purposes. At the level of children, families, and teachers, we have the issue of diagnostic purposes for instructional planning and for guiding the learning process. And then when we get down into things like tier two and tier three instruction, we're talking about things like progress monitoring, and then perhaps the need for special education. So assessment is not one thing. It has multiple users, and it has multiple purposes that have to be designed to meet the needs of those different stakeholders and purposes. Now, what that often means is that there's a whole set of questions that we have to have answered. I'm just going to flip these up there. These are some of the questions associated with different stakeholders who make use of assessment to help them figure out what's going on, to be able to plan, to be able to do things, to make decisions. Now, what this means is every school and district usually has multiple assessments. If I asked you, sort of say, you know, one of the things that we've known for a long time is if you go to districts and you go to schools and you sort of say, well, okay, what are you using for assessment? And if I were to ask you that question here, how many of you would sort of say, well, we have multiple assessments. We've got MAP, we've got this, we've got that, we've got a whole host of things. So why do we need a system of assessments? We already have a system of assessments. The answer is that's not a system of assessments, okay? In fact, what that is a collection, okay? This quote from Kaladarchi, I think, captures the point very well. A collection of assessments does not entail a system any more than a pile of bricks constitutes a house. Most of the districts that I've worked with and interacted with, they have piles of bricks, okay? I sometimes think of it as it's kind of like your closets or your garage. Over time, you've collected a bunch of stuff. Some of the stuff you're not even sure where it came from. Some of the stuff you're not sure what you use it for. And it's still in your closet and it's still in your garage. Okay? So one of the things that districts do need to do when we make a recommendation about this is to do some spring cleaning. Get rid of the crap that's in there, okay? You know, I don't even want to say send it to the Goodwill. You just get rid of it. So the analogy to think about with respect to a system is something akin to a building analogy, okay? If you're going to build a house, okay, because if you want to think about it, a house is a system, okay? And it has parts. If you're going to build that house, you have to have a number of things you have to think about to build it, to develop it, and then if you're actually going to live in it, and if it's going to be a functioning house. We can sort of talk about the things that are needed to build an assessment system. One of which is you have to think of it as a system, and I'll say more about what is a system approach in a few minutes. There has to be a design architecture. Nobody builds a house just by starting and sort of seeing where we're going. You actually have a plan. You have some architectural plan, which along the way, any of you have built a house or built anything and worked with a contractor, you know you need to make modifications along the way. Okay, that didn't quite fit there. I don't quite like the way that looks. I'm going to change the paint color. No, we're going to move the bathroom over there. Okay? You also need to have, if you're going to build an early literacy assessment system, you need to have people who have literacy development expertise. They need to be helping you design this in terms of what goes in the system and how it's supposed to function. You actually then have to have assessment tools and processes that are going to function as part of the system. In some ways, they might be part of the infrastructure for this system and this house to work. And then, of course, you need professional learning and support because you have to figure out how to make this whole thing work over time. So the important thing is to think of something as a system, not just a collection. And a system has certain properties. Now, this is an example that comes from the Center for the Assessment of Evaluation of Student Learning. It's a depiction of what oftentimes we could sort of say is a three-level system. At the top is the state assessment program. In the middle might be a district assessment program. And at the bottom, the foundation is what's happening at the classroom level. Now, notice that this pyramid, those three levels have different sizes. The majority of where assessment happens is at the school and the classroom level. There's a variety of things happening there, and there have to be systems even within that level. The point about what makes something like this, a three-level system, a system, is because it has certain properties, and that's really important to stress. What makes an integrated system is it is unified by common learning goals, which are derived from the same learning theory and conception of what it means to actually develop literacy in areas of reading, writing, speaking, and listening. Okay? It comes from research, it comes from content standards, but those are consistent. And while there may be differences at those levels in terms of grain size, that is, the assessment at the state level is a much coarser version of what's happening down at the classroom level, they have to be conceptually consistent. They have to be driven by the same concept of what constitutes essentially literacy and literacy practices. Now, the other thing that makes this a system is it's unified. They're synchronized by unifying progress variables. Progress variables are trajectories. Essentially, what is the trajectory of learning or development that we're expecting over time? Across grades with respect to reading or with respect to writing. And to the extent that we have thought about those things, then we can create synchrony that operates within the classroom level to up to the school and district level and potentially up to the state level. Some people have written recently that the most important place to focus efforts on building systems and making them function is at the district and the classroom level. The state level is a bit remote with respect to that. The state assessment should be consistent with that, but need to focus in on the district and the school and the classroom level. And the other thing is that these assessments need to be coordinated across these system levels in terms of what's happening and then the purposes. So there's really three properties that we've described for a system. And in fact, I think the first time we wrote about these, Ed, was in Knowing What Students Know. And we keep trying to emphasize these in the literature on building assessment systems, one of which is the properties of coherence. If something is going to be a system, it has to be coherent. And that means, again, this conceptual model of student learning that underlies the various assessments within the system are compatible. And as I mentioned, the conceptual base for the state or the district level assessments can be and should be a broader version of one that makes sense at the finer grain classroom level. This is why oftentimes people fail to realize that essentially a state assessment, no matter how good it is, can't really provide teachers with the information they actually need with respect to ongoing instruction. It's far too coarse, far too remote in time and space. Okay? But it doesn't have to be incoherent with respect to what are the targets of assessment. It's just remembering that essentially we need to emphasize this principle of coherence. We also need to emphasize a principle of comprehensiveness. The idea of comprehensiveness is really simple. No single assessment can do it all. In fact, the more we try to build assessments that we sort of say can do this purpose and that purpose and that purpose, we end up with what I call an engineering failure. We end up with something that is a suboptimal design because it hasn't been designed to do any of those things particularly well. It's been tried to design to do a bunch of things, and it does them in a mediocre way. So the point is that we need to have a comprehensive set of assessments and measurement approaches that can provide a variety of evidence with respect to supporting educational decision making and the various individuals who are the stakeholders in the process. In the measurement community, people always say, never make any high stakes judgment about anybody with a single measure, and yet we do that all the time somehow in the policy community. No single assessment should ever essentially be considered a definitive indicator of a student's competence. We need a range of them. And then the other thing, because we're interested in learning and development, is continuity, that we need to be able to measure student progress over time, and we need to be able to depict that progress on some sort of a trajectory so we know where we're going and where we're at, particularly if we want to move students along that trajectory in the most optimal way. So we need models of student progress that should underlie the assessment system. So when we think about what districts need to do, you need to put in place what I call a local assessment system. And a local assessment system has to do certain things. It needs to focus on the important aspects of literacy and its development. It needs to meet the needs of different stakeholders. And it needs to be conceptually and operationally coherent. And here's where the rub is, okay? The rub is that in order to do this well, you really need a theory of action that's related to users and uses. Because one of the most common problems that we see when we look across state, district, and classroom levels is that the assessment components are not coherent. They don't align with each other. They don't align with the same conception of literacy. They have different underlying sort of, you might sort of say, conceptual models. It goes back to what is the cognitive piece underlying assessment? What is your conception of the components of literacy and how it develops? And so the result is we get conflicting results. We get inferences about students that don't seem to line up. And what happens is people sort of then sort of say, well, that assessment isn't any good. This isn't working. And essentially, they want to throw things out. It doesn't lead to being able to do good planning because we don't know why we're getting the incoherence or the inconsistency. So one of the things that people talk about, write about with respect to systems is you need to make explicit your assumptions about literacy, and you need a theory of action related to the use of the information that's going to be derived from the system of assessments. One of my favorite cartoons is one that comes from Harris that was published in Science many years ago. You can read that and you notice it says, I think you need to be more explicit here in step two, where it says, then a miracle occurs. I think when we design and implement a lot of assessments in education, we're hoping for miracles, okay? Because we haven't really thought through how A connects to B connects to C. We would love miracles, but we need to be a little more practical than that. So a theory of action is really important. And what is it? It's essentially a logically stated argument. You lay out your assumptions. You make a hypothesis about how something's supposed to work. And then essentially you specify how the pieces fit together and the connections and the manner in which they're supposed to work. The theory of action says, if we have this and it's used this way, this should be the consequence. It allows you to actually sort of say what, why we're doing something, who's supposed to use it, and what's supposed to be the outcome. Now, this is a sort of complicated diagram, which sort of represents both a structure as well as a theory of action, an implicit theory of action for literacy instruction and assessment. It starts with learning theory. It starts with what we know about literacy, which then ostensibly guides the development of state standards, which in turn guide the state summative assessment system. Essentially, those same things influence curriculum in the area of literacy, and hopefully the state assessment is aligned with that as well. Notice that in this diagram there are alignments and connections. We may have a local assessment system, which is also sort of connected. But then we get into what's happening at the classroom. Unit planning, which is a function of both what we know about learning as well as the curriculum. And then we get into the details of all of these elements of what's happening now at the level of the school and the classroom. And when we look at all of these connections, what we begin to see, the pieces, and we can unpack what's underneath that in terms of how A leads to B, influences C, et cetera. Now, there's a lot that could be unpacked about the theory of action associated with these components, who uses them and how they work. And we don't have time for that. But one thing I do want to point out is notice the box that's put upon up over that, which is it speaks to the fact that for something like this to work, there has to be sustained professional development so that individuals know how to use these components and use them well in order for this system to function. So you can't do this, and you can't just develop a system without thinking, particularly at the level you want to influence, which is what's happening with kids in classrooms and their literacy development, without thinking of the professionals who actually have to run your system for you and actually have to influence what's happening. So in the systems literature and discussions of theories of action, one of the things that is emphasized is the development of what's called a logic model. A logic model is a way to help you uncover what is your theory of action, and it forces you to specify what that theory of action is and how to make it explicit. And what the logic model, if you actually use it as a process, does, it allows you to surface the details. It builds a structural plan. It doesn't completely do everything for you, but by engaging in a theory of action and a logic model process, you start to uncover what you need, what are the components, how to fit them together, how they're supposed to work, and how you're going to develop this, implement it, and evaluate it. I'm going to skip over this slide, but this is the kind of thing that people sort of use as a graphic because it outlines the elements you need to think about. This is not a logic model for an assessment system, but it is an attempt to sort of capture the key parts of laying out a logic model for any kind of complicated program. The important thing about the theory of action and logic model for an early literacy assessment system is that there are a variety of things you need to do. Some of them you have to articulate prior to assessment system design, like what's the purpose of the system, what's your theory of learning, what are the goals of the system, and who are the intended users and users of the results. That you have to sort of, you have to be explicit about that before you actually then engage in the specific design. And then, as part of the design and part of the development of this logic model and system, you now have to deal with all these other things, okay? That is the manner in which the assessment system will bring about the desired change. That is, what are your design principles? I'll get there in a minute. The design of the system and its component parts, the mechanisms by which the components are supposed to meet the goals, What are the relationships among those components? Be explicit about that. How is A related to B, and how does B influence back on A? And then what are the inferences and assumptions you're making about how the system is supposed to work? If it's working as intended, what are you supposed to see? How's it supposed to happen? So there's a take-home message about assessment and assessment systems that can be captured in a couple of key points. One, designing good assessment is a very challenging thing. It turns out that what you need is really solid conceptual foundation about what students should know and how they should know it. Assessment is just not a simple one thing. It's not a simple matter. It takes multiple forms. And it needs to meet multiple purposes. And one of the major challenges that we have found over time, regardless of what's been written about assessment, regardless of all the wonderful guides, is that it is helping teachers use assessment productively in their practice, in their ongoing practice, especially formative assessment. Many of the conceptions of teachers about assessment is rooted in a summative perspective, a large-scale assessment perspective. And so this is a transformational process. I know that in Michigan, the MAC has produced wonderful resources to support formative assessment among teachers, but this is a major lift. And then assessment doesn't sit off by itself. It needs to be part of an integrated system of curriculum, instruction, assessment, and teacher professional learning. So that's kind of the foundational thinking. You might sort of say, well, okay, so now what do we do? What can we do with all this wonderful knowledge? Well, what we've tried to do is to provide a set of what we call organizing and design principles. Because if you really think about what a system is and how you're going to get there, you have to think about, well, what are the design principles that have to undergird developing this? And so in order to get from where we are to where we need to be, we have highlighted five principles to help direct this journey. And we've organized those five principles in terms of three phases of developing and implementing this system. So the first phase is actually this process of planning for designing an early literacy assessment system. Now, schools and districts are complex ecologies. They have many other systems in place. You can't just design an assessment system and just say, okay, throw it into there. It's like throwing something into an existing ecology without thinking about the nature of that ecology and how things work in that system. So you have to think about this system and how it articulates with other systems, the system of curriculum, instruction, other assessment, and professional learning, in order for an assessment system to actually function and survive. So you have to design with that larger context in mind. You are going into a complex ecology. It means that you need to think about a variety of things, about the conditions that support coherent systems. You need to think about how the work is integrated with other initiatives. This is complex, long-term, intentional, and deliberate work and thinking. It isn't just something, we're going to pull something off the shelf, throw it out there, see if it works. Another piece of this is considerable human capital is needed on the design side. And that human capital involves administrators as well as teachers and principals, because you can't design something for a set of users where those users have not been part of that design process. And because this is so important to young people, you need to engage students and families in authentic ways with respect to what you are trying to do and how, and get their input and be part of this process. So one principle is this idea of thinking about the system within systems and the conditions that need to be there in order for this system to be able to take root and function and not compete with other existing systems. The second principle in this planning and design phase is that it has to reflect assessment design features that I mentioned earlier that make it coherent, comprehensive, and continuous across time and contexts of use. It's another way of saying you need to pay attention to the architecture. And that includes fundamentals about assessment, the way the things fit together, those three principles I mentioned of comprehensiveness, coherence, and continuity. And as I pointed out, you need to be able to do the hard work up front about thinking about a theory of action and beginning to develop some sort of logic model for what you are going to build and how it's going to work. That is the first phase. These two principles relate to this, essentially, this planning phase and designing phase. But then we get to the second phase. When you've done a lot of this hard work and thinking, you start to actually think about implementing an early literacy assessment system. This is the second phase. The third principle goes back to something very fundamental. It has to reflect what we know from theory, research, and practice about literacy development. It turns out we know a great deal about literacy development, and that knowledge can help guide the choices we make. So in our report, we lay out some of the background behind eight features of an early literacy assessment system that pay explicit attention to what we know about literacy development and learning. And I'm just going to highlight a couple of these just to sort of show you what underlies these features. So feature one, a system that's developmentally sensitive means that we take into account the range of purposes for which we use reading, writing, and oral language, as well as the kinds of resources that support literacy tasks and activity, and it anticipates the context in which we will use literacy over time, from pre-K up through grades 1, 2, 3, and beyond. This illustration is the range of ways in which literacy gets used, just some of the examples. Another feature is that the system needs to be able to identify whether students are receiving excellent early literacy instruction. We know that excellent instruction has a profound effect on students' ability to develop reading and literacy skills. And we have to intervene, and we have to have good instruction very early on. We can't sort of try to catch up at the end. So the system has to be able to detect what's happening in terms of whether kids are getting what they need or getting quality instruction. Another feature is that it needs to take into account the complexities of something like reading comprehension and reflect the dynamic and developmental nature of comprehension. This has to do with being attuned to the kinds of texts that work for younger readers rather than older readers, the whole principle of text cohesion, and quite frankly, it's not just selecting texts on the basis of lexiles, okay? It has to do with a deeper understanding about the nature of text structure, text processing, and the role the genre plays in reading and reading comprehension and its development. And the last thing is, don't forget about student interests, okay, and motivation. One of the things that's very important in literacy and literacy development is that you are attuned to the interests of your students, and that you are using things that are culturally and developmentally relevant and interesting, and that you take this into account, both in terms of your assessment and also when you're reporting your assessment results. So these are features that you need to now pay attention to when you're thinking about the assessments themselves and how they fit together. Now, this fourth principle relates to also implementing this system, and it says that, okay, on top of that, you now have to remember the purposes, the users, and you have to consider technical adequacy of these early literacy assessments, okay? And we're going to, at the session this afternoon, I think it's E1, we're going to say more about the details of this. But the idea is what I said earlier. You have to think about purposes, users, and technical adequacy. What do we mean by technical adequacy? Is the assessment good enough to do the job that's intended, if it's a low stakes or a high stakes one? Is it reliable? Is it valid? Is it fair? So we want a balanced assessment system that includes assessment for learning and assessment of learning. We need to consider, essentially, who's going to use these assessments, what kind of decisions they're going to make, and as I said, technical adequacy, but also what we're assessing. What aspects of reading are we assessing? What aspects of writing? And all of this happens in the context of these different domains of reading, writing, speaking, and listening. As I said, this afternoon, Brandy, Adria, Unsu, and I will be talking more about this in terms of some of the specifics of what this means. The last phase is, the third phase is, okay, you've done all this work, now you've sort of developed the system. How do you support and monitor an early literacy assessment? You can't just throw it out there and sort of say, okay, here it is, now make it work. You have to think about essentially a sustained program of collaborative, inquiry-based professional learning and feedback. You need to have feedback in the system. You need to think of formative evaluation in the system as well as essentially support for those who are going to implement it, which means that you need to engage in professional learning following many of the principles that have been articulated already in Michigan for professional learning. But the point is, professional learning is a key part of this, and it is, and so the assessment system and how it works should be built into that whole process. So a summary about these principles is that you need to have and try to think through a theory of action and logic model. You need to lay out the components. You need to focus on coherence and clarity. You need to avoid an unnecessary proliferation of assessments. Remember what I said before. The closet you have already of the assessments you have in your school and district, or the garage you have, essentially, the first thing you need to do is, before you build something new, is to clean out the closet. It's kind of like my wife says, if you're going to buy something new, something old's got to come out of the closet, okay? And that's a very good policy, okay? Because the fact that you have it doesn't mean you should keep it. You need to have criteria for selection, many different criteria, including technical adequacy. And I put up there, and this is, yeah, I mean this very seriously, caveat emptor. Mm-hmm. Now, with all due deference to the folks who are helping to sponsor this conference and the assessment companies, don't just buy what they're selling, okay? Ask hard questions about what they are selling is going to meet the needs of your system. Don't just accept their word for it. Okay, you are in a precarious position where you need to do these things, and there are providers. You need to actually think about negotiating this space. You need to be an intelligent consumer in this space, and you need to have plans for monitoring use and outcomes. So I'm going to finish up just with a few words about the guide for the journey, and then I'm actually will have met my time, Ed. Because you haven't sort of walked up here to pull the hook. So, as I said, the group has produced a guide. This is a picture of the cover, I think, as it exists now, thanks to the wonderful assistance of people like Linda and Kathy and others on the team. So this guide is meant as a foundation for the development of policy, resources, and professional learning. How did we get there? Well, stage one brought together the groups of experts that we talked about, experts in literacy instruction, literacy assessment, assessment systems, and we constituted two groups. The one I showed you the pictures of all the folks who are the principal contributors, but there are also a responder group, which is individuals in the state of Michigan representing various constituencies who communicate with the field. And we went back and forth and exchanged ideas with them, got very valuable feedback about essentially what we were working on, how we communicate it, and hopefully found a level at which we could communicate effectively with the field, and that will be up for you to determine ultimately. So a little bit about the structure of the guide. There's a brief introduction laying out just the context. The section one of the guide is sort of relatively short. It is focused in on what are the principles, what are the recommendations, and sort of how are they aligned with these different phases. There's a section two I want to mention. It is a great section, and I hope people read it and use it. It is what we call principles in action, or what we call the portraits. to illustrate early literacy development and the role of assessment and instruction in the different people's participants in that, we follow three young children over the course of kindergarten or pre-K up through grade two with a projection into grade three to illustrate points about literacy development and forms of assessment. It's a great professional development tool. I hope people will use it. It reflects a number of insights about the literacy development process. Section three, that's the long piece. There's five pieces in there. That's all the backing behind the principles and the recommendations. It gives the rationale, but it also points out sets of resources that people can use to implement things that we're saying. And then there's a glossary and references and other valuable information. So, go back to the road ahead. We don't have an early literacy assessment system that we can give you, okay? We don't have one in a box and sort of say, here. And in fact, if we had one in a box, you'd tell us that's not gonna fit my box because every district is gonna be a little bit different. The point is, you have to build this, and there's a long and winding road ahead. Okay, if I had some music, you don't want me to sing, but you know, you get the idea. Imagine the Beatles. As I showed you, there are organizing and design principles. Five of these organized in terms of three phases. In addition, and you can't read that, and I never intended you to. We don't just put the principles up there, we make a set of recommendations for how to go about doing this, and we provide information about relevant resources, okay? It is still going to take a lot of work to do this, but hopefully you'll find that this guide is valuable. While you're here, if possible, you can explore the executive summary. It turns out that we actually have some copies available at the MAC exhibit table, but you can also find it in the resources for the conference, particularly for session E1. So the executive summary, which contains the principles, the recommendations, and a little of the context, it's a nice little sort of foldover that Linda helped design. And the full report should be available by the end of this month, the beginning of March. So I thank you for listening, and I encourage you in the hard work that's ahead to build early literacy assessment systems. Thank you.
Well, I hope you found that as valuable as I did. I want to indicate, first of all, our thanks to Jim for coming over. We tapped him because of that combination that Ed Silver talked about, that deep understanding of research and ability to relate to practicalities. The ELAS guide is really designed to help you with what I think is the conundrum presented by the Read by Grade 3 legislation. And we think of two courses of action as laid out in the law. Students may be retained or they may be promoted. But in reality, there's a third condition that we hope is the one that becomes prevalent, and that is that kids become literate by grade three. So the issue of retention or social promotion is a non-issue. Retention, we know, has consequences. But so does social promotion. And the consequences of retention are more immediate. And then reading in some of the education literature, I've read the districts that are just going to ignore the law and socially promote students. And we know, unfortunately, that social promotion has longer term, much more severe consequences. And so what's the way we out of this conundrum? By helping kids to become literate by grade three. I hope the report has significant recommendations for local educators. This isn't a report about what the state does. This is a report about what local districts do and schools and buildings and classroom teachers and parents and their families. So I hope that you'll get a copy of it, that your district will begin to use it and to study it. There's recommendations in it for how it can be implemented. It's only through that kind of action that we'll get out of this situation of whether we retain or socially promote students, neither of which is positive for their benefit. Okay, I'm off the soapbox now. We're going to be moving this air wall down here. And remember, I'm asking the people over here in Michigan 3 through 5 to exit. Go out, get some coffee, get a snack, let them move the air walls without us hitting anyone. And we'll get started in about 10 minutes.